Ladies and gentlemen, please. My name is Patrick O'Reilly. I'm the chair of the Psychology Forum. It is an absolute delight for me to welcome Dr. Carol Fleming as a speaker. I've heard her speak before. She's immensely entertaining. I always learn something, but I'm always amused and entertained as well. She's a personal communications coach, and she's the author of a book, incidentally, a new book, which I just bought. It's for sale out in the lobby. And also the author of two other books, The Sound of Your Voice and The Serious Business of Small Talk, both of which, incidentally, are on CD, and they're available in the lobby as well for sale. And we are here to welcome her for her new book, which is called It's the Way You Say It, Becoming Articulate, Well-Spoken, and Clear. And this is actually the very first comprehensive guide to communication skill development from a professional viewpoint that's directed specifically at the general public, at the layperson. Dr. Fleming has earned her doctorate at Northwestern University and has been in private practice, actually right across the street, right across Market Street, for quite some time. She's very active in the Commonwealth Club. She's on the board of governors in the Commonwealth Club, and she's in charge of all the member-led forums. The last time Carol spoke at the club, she did an analysis of the Gettysburg Address, which was wonderful. This time she will share with us some stories from her unique work in helping people with their concerns with personal communications. And again, her book will be for sale out in the lobby, so please welcome Dr. Fleming.
So what is a personal communication coach? Good question, because I just made it up. So I get to tell you what it is. It's a PhD speech pathologist who offers services. All right. Now, do I need to get closer to it? Do I need a smaller box, Patrick? How's this? Can you hear me? Now, is that good? All right. I'll promise to stay right here. It's a PhD speech pathologist who's offered the skills and knowledge and experience to the general public. Okay. Now, it started when I was a conventional speech pathologist in a medical building and found that I had as many physicians and administrative staff of the hospital coming to me for help as I did people with organic concerns of communication. This was a surprise to me. It would be the radiologists who cannot speak unless you turn off all the lights and turn on the PowerPoint. It would be the pathologists who were absolutely paralyzed at any social interaction. The young female MDs who maintained speech patterns of femininity and deference while trying to maintain a professional demeanor. The foreign-born docs who could not make themselves understood by patients. And the general physician whose articulation was similar to their handwriting. So I opened the doors to the general public, and I learned a lot from them. I learned that there were three kinds of people that came to me for two main reasons. And that's going to be the focus of my talk today. And when I'm done, I hope that we have enough time for your particular questions about your personal communication skills. So, the kinds of people that I have seen over these many years, first of all, those who feel they have some kind of problem with their own communication, those who are sent by a parent or an employer, and believe me, that feels a lot different than coming in because you want to. And third, those who just really wanted to be good at some particular communication task. For example, if you have to give the toast at your brother's wedding as best man, you really intend to steal the show if you can at all. So, and I'm going to illustrate all of these kinds of concerns with my own verbal PowerPoint. So I'm going to ask you to cooperate with me and let the slides go through your head. And we'll start with Lenny. And Leonard came to me because he had a problem. He was a PhD from MIT in a very technical field, and he had never been able to get a job at his level of expertise. He'd been on the market for 10 years. And every year, he would have to take some kind of minimal occupation just to support himself because he just could not get a foot in the door. So he was telling me about the various villainies in his job search, the favoritism, the politics, and all these people that just betrayed him in the last 10 years, which explained why he was not employed at the PhD MIT level. So while he was talking, I videotaped him, and when we were done, I showed him some of the tape. And he watched very gravely. I turned it off. There was a long silence. And he finally said, "I look like a serial killer." And he did. And he sounded like one, too. Now, how does a serial killer sound? Minimal vocal variety. Every word was said pretty much at the same rate, at the same level of loudness, at the same pitch constriction. So it was kind of spooky to talk with Leonard. But the point here is he had no idea of his personal impact. He didn't know how he was coming across. And I want you to register this in your head because it's an important thing to learn tonight, that the vast majority of people don't have a clue of how they come across to other people. You know what you intend, but you don't really know what they're getting. And so here's Leonard having to confront the nature of the signal of his own communication that explained a lot about his failure to get into any kind of institution. So after he said that, I did what any good therapist would do. I shut up. Because there's nothing you can say that's going to be appropriate at that moment. So he had a very profound insight into his own impact, and I can only wish that more people had that opportunity, because you could save yourself a lot of time if you would just listen to yourself in a normally recorded situation. You'll find out more about yourself than any psychiatrist could tell you. So I want you to think about that you probably assume that people do know the impression they make by the way they speak, that they mean it, that it's part of their intention, and probably they don't. Other people have a very different kind of experience that I want to tell you about. When I have them listen to themselves, I know that they're going to be so self-critical, so looking for something to find fault with. Ooh, I said, you know. Oh, I repeated myself. No big deal. No big deal. So I often have to caution people and say, it's okay to say, I sound a lot better than I thought I would. Because a lot of people, having been given permission, do in fact say that. And it's a wonderful thing to find out that you can be relieved of a lot of your own self-criticism by actually listening to yourself. So I highly recommend that. Now, Linda was one who was sent to me by her employer because her voice was too loud. Okay, so Linda walks in. Of course, I'm listening very carefully, and I'm hearing normal voice usage. But let me tell you what I'm seeing. I'm seeing long, kind of frizzy hair that's simply just hanging there. There's no do. I'm seeing a cotton peasant blouse and a cotton frilly skirt. I am seeing hands that fly in the air all the time she's talking. She would be a great personification of the Italian peasant. Now, let me tell you about Linda's hands. They were large, and they were not manicured. There's what we used to call dishpan hands. Remember dishpan hands? Linda had dishpan hands. And so when she would talk, almost everything she said was accompanied by these big lobster claws in your face. So I'm observing her talk, and I'm listening to her talk, and I think, Linda, tell me about your employer. Well, she's a very petite woman, very elegant, slim, soft-spoken, Asian, rich. And the other people in the office call her Dragon Lady. So I'm picturing, Dragon Lady here, Italian peasant there. How's that going to work? How's that going to get along? So I kind of thought we've got a social class problem here, if not an expressive stylistic problem here. So I had Linda show me a typical report she might do for her employer. And she sort of managed the office, and she would go in and tell the employer what's going on with whatever. So I had her stand in front of me and do a report, but take her thumbs and fasten them in the seams in her skirt down on her thigh. Just stick your thumb in there and keep it there while you talk. Darn near killed her. She huffed and puffed and gasped in trying to figure out how you talk without using your hands, too. You know, I have been known to use duct tape for similar kinds of problems where the person is so connected with their verbal expressiveness with manual expressiveness in order to separate them, and they're unaware of it, so just tape them down and learn how it feels to talk without using your hands. Because I had a theory here. So we did that. And we spent the rest of our time together of her doing reports with me with her thumb stuck in her thighs. So she goes back to the office. And as it happens, the copier broke down that afternoon. The office was in an uproar. She had to go try to fix it, and if not fix it, find somebody to fix it, and then go report to her employer. Okay. So about an hour later, I got a phone call from the employer. Dr. Fleming, you are a genius. Her voice is much softer now. Okay, so I hope nobody in this room will tell her that I never touched her voice at all. Okay, so that leads to the next great truth that I learned from working with the general public, that very few people are very good at understanding and describing speech and voice and language with any kind of accuracy. Some are, but a whole bunch aren't. So you have to take any kind of referral or description with a grain of salt, because there's a lot of folks that are just way off. Then there's the people who want to be really good. And I'm going to tell you about Hannah. Was a 17-year-old country girl from King County, wherever that is. And she was a candidate to be queen of the rodeo of the Cattlemen's Association. So part of what they had to do, besides look gorgeous and ride their horse in a parade, I don't know, maybe they twirled a baton, I don't know, but was to give a little talk in front of the Cattlemen's Association. So here's, what, a half a dozen of these maidens with their white cowboy hats and their sparkly shirts going up to the microphone to talk to the Cattlemen's Association. Now, these young ladies did something like this. Hi, my name is Wendy, and I'm just so excited to be here. And I'm really, really glad to be chosen to be a princess. And my horse is named Ginger, and I just love her so much. We're best friends. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So So here's what I had Hannah do. Gentlemen and cowboys of the Cattlemen Association of King County, I want to be your queen. So something a little different, wouldn't you say? Okay. So Linda, Lenny, the radio queen are the kind of stories I tell about in my book, It's the Way You Say It, because people are just so much more interesting than problems. Is there a seat for this lady here? How about right up here? There's Kevin, there's a seat right up here. Okay, all right. Now, people come to me for two main reasons. Now, they never use these words. But if I stand back and look at what motivates people to seek out help with their personal communication, is they want poise and they want power. Poise and power. So, poise, how do we, how does that come up? Well, there's two situations where poise is very important. And the first one is in social conversation with strangers, making small talk at mixers, at parties, at Commonwealth Club meetings with people that you don't know. People feel very ill at ease in being able to handle that. Now, people underestimate the underpinnings of small talk. I taught an all-day course just on the topic of small talk, and you may be thinking, what? You can talk all day on chit-chat? Okay. The answer is yes. It is very underappreciated. The dynamics, the courtesies, the way that you build and artfully sculpt a conversation with a total stranger, there is much to know. And you don't know that there is something to know, and that is why you are so ill at ease. People also hate stage fright. Am I right? Anybody here enjoy stage fright? I don't think so. And on the plus side, they want respect. And they want finesse. So those are the four topics I want to talk about today and give you examples of each and some practical tips that might help you in dealing with any of these issues. So first, let's go back to social conversation, which is a much, as I say, misunderstood topic. Social conversation, chit-chat about the weather. Let's just take the weather now. Is not really about the weather. It's in disguise. It's a series of vocal signals from one human animal to the other one, trying to establish friendly intent. That's all it is. There's the ostensible topic, which is merely subterfuge, to just make noises at each other to see, can we get this ball rolling between us and have some kind of relationship. Secondly, small talk is a mechanism to search for a genuine topic of interest, something that you both honestly do want to talk about. So it has a job to do. Here are the three areas of social conversation that I think you hate the most. One is, how do you get it started? Breaking the ice. What do you say to this total stranger? Am I right? Okay. A second one is, once it's off the ground, it crashes and burns. And you're just standing there looking at each other, and you've got nothing to say. Gee, it's a lovely day today. Sure is. Okay, you don't know how to keep it going, how to go out and start your search for a genuine conversation. And thirdly, how do you get out of a tedious conversation? That is a very popular topic. But the one I want to talk with you today is one that nobody else ever talks about. So I want to talk about how you keep the conversation going and even find that genuine topic that you both really want to talk about. Because I will say, any one of you could have a wonderful conversation with any other person in this room if you knew how to search out that meaningful topic with patience and free information. And I'm going to tell you a story that illustrates this. And it happened to me, and it happened just this last week. I went into Macy's because I needed a particular color of lipstick. Okay, if you know me, you know I will go out and look for a particular color of lipstick. And I stopped at one of the counters. It happened to be the Clinique counter. And I was looking at lipsticks with this Clinique lady. And we saw what would be the right color, but they were out of it. And this Clinique lady said, wouldn't you know it, we probably got a dozen of them, you know, up in Yakima, Washington, but we don't have them here. Ha, 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 ha. And I started to turn away, and I turned back. I said, why did you say Yakima? I'm curious because I have family up there. You know, of all the places to pick in the whole wide world, you say Yakima. And she says, you do? She said, I do too. My aunt's there. I said, well, I've got an aunt there. My aunt Fritzy has lived there all her life. And she says, you've got to be kidding. My aunt emails me every week about her bridge game and her doing, and there's a Fritzy in her bridge group. And this Fritzy is 96 years old, drives a car, lives alone, sews clothes, and, oh, she dresses like a fashion model. Bingo. So here we are, two nieces over the Clinique counter, talking about our aunts, who are bridge partners. You want a small chorus? It's a small world. But how did that happen? I mean, that's a delicious moment, isn't it? Wouldn't you just love that? It's wonderful. That didn't happen except for her saying Yakima, Washington, a specific word. A specific proper noun allowed the meaningful chain to start getting built. And that's what I want you to get out of this particular story here. Because you are accustomed to talking in generalities. You might say, took the family on vacation. When I would rather have you say, I took my twins up to Yosemite for their first camping experience. How does that feel to you? Like some kind of scary, dangerous? Because if you heard it in a conversation, wouldn't you have more ways of talking with that person? Because maybe you have twins. Maybe you just got back from Yosemite. Maybe you had your family at a first camping experience. And think of those as hooks that you can grab on to develop a real conversation. Whereas if you use a generality, you know, I'm going to go walk my dog after work. Well, how about walk my Doberman? You got more of a topic there, don't you? Use a specific, proper term. We're going to have a reception after my talk, and I invite all of you to come up and start a conversation, or even with each other, and see how much free information you can get into a beginning conversation, because it can very well turn out that you two strangers share an interest, a passion, a relative that you will never know about unless you play that card with the specific term, because the brain just works differently. When you say, you know, up in Washington as opposed to Yakima. Okay, so try that tonight and see if you can force yourself to get over your habit of generalities and go right into specifics. Let's talk about stage fright. Another one of those topics which can take an all-day course. But I want to give you one thing to think about and try. If you are among the many that has a very uncomfortable feeling whenever you have to give a talk. Are you here in the audience, people with uncomfortable feelings for public speaking? Okay. Let me ask you to try to turn any presentation into a conversation. And I'll tell you a story that illustrates this. And it actually had to do with a landscape architect who came to me because he worked for a developer of a resort that was going in at Tahoe. Okay? You can imagine how the local community felt about a resort coming in up at Tahoe. Okay, hot topic. So at the last minute, this developer decides that he does not want to go to this meeting with the townspeople to defend the resort development. He's going to send the landscape architect instead. Well, this nice man, Jason, was practically crawled into my office in horror that he's got to go up to Tahoe and face the local people up there who have their guns out to mow him down for daring to put a resort in up at Tahoe. You can imagine, can't you? So I asked Jason to go up early, to go up a day early, and just hang out in the town there. Go to the laundromat, go to the restaurant, gas station, library, and talk to people about what they knew about the development. And take notes, take names, find out the issues, and learn them. So when he opened his talk, here's how he opened it. I know there's a lot of concern in this room about the development coming in. You're concerned about traffic, pollution, the skyline, trail availability, and I understand that. I was talking with Matt over here just the other day, and he went early. He met a guy named Matt. Matt told him. So now he's pointing right at Matt and said, he enjoys riding his horse on the trails that snake through these hills, and he doesn't want to lose that because he's trying to give that to his children as a great experience here. And I want Matt and all of you to know that that trail is going to be part of the public domain. And the Williams family here enjoys the skyline of all of the trees, and they don't want to see a smokestack. They don't want to see any change in the way things look. And I can promise you, this development is down in the valley, and you will not have to see any sign of that. So he just picked off as many of these issues right at the beginning. I use the term pulling out their teeth. Instead of starting off with, here's about the development, he started off with, here's about you and your concern. Now, how would that make you feel as an audience? This guy listened first. This guy respected what we had to say. The people that he named kind of sat up a little straighter, and my opinion counts here. This man consulted with me, and I told him. So they stood a little straighter, and the people in the audience say, started nodding. So pretty soon, Jason had a conversation going with these people by disarming them first, by listening to them first, before he tried to tell them anything. So if you have to give a talk, go early, meet some people, get the exchange going so you find out, how can I help these people? What brought them here? What do I know that they need to hear? So when you come up here and talk to them, you just keep that conversation going with them, and you've broken that me versus them barrier. So try that the next time you have to give a talk, and I think you'll make yourself a lot more comfortable when you do so. So I want to talk about power now. Gosh, this is such a big part of my work, because people want respect. They want to be perceived as mature and knowledgeable. And they kind of know that there's something about the way they talk that can give it away or build it, and they're absolutely right. So let's look at the dimensions of power in your speech here. In general, we can say that power does not rush. Power is pretty deliberate in its speech rate. The faster you talk, you are communicating your excitement and emotion and not your intelligence, which is more thoughtful and chooses language deliberately. So if you are one who blurts and rushes, you are impinging on your power quotient. We also do know that if it's one-on-one situation, the more you match your speech rate with the person you're talking to, the more they will perceive you as an intelligent person. So there's a variable there. If they talk really fast, you should speed it up. If they talk really slow, you take it down a notch as best you can. Okay. So its pitch rate is a variable that you can mess with that we know makes a difference in the sense of relationship. Power does not use verbal hyperbole. You know that word, hyperbole? Okay, well, for those of you who don't, I really am so excited about this fantastic number of people who came here. Empty language to jack it up emotionally with the so's and the really's and the fantastics and terrifics and adorable. That kind of language is, again, emotional and exciting and not thoughtful and not mature. You need to get aware if you sprinkle too many of those words in your talk, because they do detract from your credibility. Power has a lower pitch. Well, you all know that. You all know that. Between the large animals and the small animals, who has the lower voice? The large animal, doesn't it? Between the adult and the child, who has the lower voice? Between the predator and the prey, who has the lower voice? Between the male and the female, who has the lower voice? So you see how it works, don't you? And that's why you all are very concerned with the pitch level of your voice. I've had so many people who come into my office and say, "Dr. Fleming, I think my voice is too high." This reverts back to that first thing that people don't have a clue of how they really sound, okay? Because psychologically, they kind of know that the higher voice marks you as young, frail, small, and powerless. That's how it works. And power speaks in simple declarative sentences. To illustrate that, I want to read a paragraph from a book by Lee Child. Do you know Lee Child? Jack Reacher? Any Jack Reacher fans here? I know of a few. I want you to listen to this language now, how it strikes you emotionally. 5 minutes to 3 in the afternoon. Exactly 61 hours before it happened. The lawyer drove in and parked in the empty lot. There was an inch of new snow on the ground, so he spent a minute fumbling in the footwell until his overshoes were secure. Then he got out and turned his collar up and walked into the visitor's entrance. There was a bitter wind out of the north. It was thick with fat, lazy flakes. There was a storm 60 miles away. Okay, got the feeling? Well, let's read it in a different way. It was 5 minutes to three in the afternoon, exactly 61 hours before it happened, and the lawyer drove in and parked in the empty lot, and there was an inch of snow on the ground, so he spent a minute fumbling in the footwell until his overshoes were secure. Then he got out and turned up his collar and walked to the visitor's entrance. Got the feeling? Okay. So did you feel the power in the first form, which was completely due to the deliberate pace and the tendency of the intonation pattern to go down, even within the sentence? For example, then he got out and he turned his collar up and walked to the visitor's entrance. Instead of he got out, turned his collar up, and walked to the visitor's entrance. So that one little aspect of sentence formation is tremendously powerful in communicating a lot of deliberate thought and being a heavyweight. Now, I'm not saying you should talk this way all the time with every sentence, but the more of these you use, especially when you need to give a serious communication to somebody and want a lot of impact, go for the simple declarative sentence. Take out the modifiers, take out the hyperbole, and take out the upendings, and make simple declarative sentences. Say what you mean. Say it clearly. Say it deliberately. Did you hear that? That will be heard and processed as a very powerful message. So you might try that out at the reception, too. I want to talk about finesse. Now, I said that was one of the reasons people came to see me. I lied. I wish they came to see me for that. I wish they did. One of the things I'm sad about is that so many people come in order to be okay, huh? To get by. They can just get through something. And there's a whole big realm of eloquence and finesse available to the human mind and vocabulary that's there if you just raise your sights to think that maybe you could do that, because you can. And if you just try to go on get by level, it's not likely that you will reach it. Were some of you here when I spoke about the Gettysburg Address? You may have remembered that of the many things we found to admire about that, the one that completely enthralled me, at any rate, was the way he organized it, for heaven's sakes. Who'd have thunk it? You know? The organizational principles of the Gettysburg Address are amazing and cause it to be 279 words that go down so easily by these subliminal features in the way the ideas and words were put together. That's eloquence, and I love it when people pay a little attention to that kind of thing and go for it. But I want to leave with a couple examples of inspiring finesse. There's an expression, the aptly spoken word is like a golden apple on a silver setting. Now, I love those golden apples of verbal and nonverbal finesse. So I want to leave you with some of those today. First one, a verbal one. I was down here at the restaurant just down on 2nd Street here, Italian restaurant. And for my appetizer, I ordered a clam chowder. Were you there with me, Milo? You may have been. And I was reaching to my clam chowder. I took a bite, and there was sand in the clam. And when that happens, you know it right away. You stop. You spit it out. You put your spoon down, and you get the waiter and say, it goes. You're not going to eat that. And I got a little back talk. Oh, madam, we wash our seafood. We wash the clams very carefully. There was sand in the clam. Okay? So he's taking it back to the kitchen, and I notice the maitre d' stops him, and they have an agitated discussion with, you know, a lot of that Italian expressiveness we were talking about. And the soup goes in, and the main course is about to come out, and the maitre d' walks over to me. I don't know what to expect at this point. What's going to happen here? He comes over. He takes my hand and brushes it with his lips and says, "Madam, with more customers like you, we will become a better restaurant." Did he not take the sand out of that clam? Yes, 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 yes. What was the name of that restaurant? Begins with U. You remember? Umbria. Everybody, go down and eat at Umbria's, because they're not going to have sand in their clams anymore. And this, just that gesture, that golden apple, you know, I will love for a very long time at the skill of that man to say the one phrase that just completely turned it all around. That's wonderful. Now I will tell you a story of nonverbal finesse. And it's a story about me. I claim it with some pride. And I hope any of you that are at my funeral will remember me this way. So please take some notes here. A Korean evangelist came to me because he was losing his voice, and well he should, because he was so passionate in his preaching. And he was a world player. And he was out there exhorting people to believe in whatever it was he was believing, jumping around that stage and yelling and moving his arms and exhorting them to, as I say, to whatever it was. And he's losing his voice, and he wanted me to fix that. So he came in with his handler. Now, he was a man who never drove. He didn't pay any bill. He's got someone who does all these things for him. So he sat at the table across from me, and his handler was at the couch here beside us. And it is my routine to offer you a glass of water anytime you come visit me in my office, because I want to start building the habits of hydration as part of vocal health. Just get in the habit of socking down the water so that the mucosal lining of your vocal folds stay moist and flexible and healthy. So we all have a glass of water. Well, Korean evangelist Reverend Kim, we'll call him, is making some point to me, and does a great gesture like this, and there goes his glass of water flying out. The handler immediately reaches out to, like, grab it, and in so doing, kicks over her glass of water. So I immediately grab mine and just pour it on top. I am so proud of that moment, because I didn't even think about it, and that whole scenario took less than 2 seconds, certainly, maybe 1 second. I thought, that was exactly the right thing to do. So that story and many others are in the book. And if you liked my stories today, you just might like my book, and I hope that you do. So let me conclude now. And I don't know how much time I have for questions. Is anybody, I think, Patrick, about 5 minutes? Let's have a question in the back. Yes.
And for the first time, I heard my voice.
And what did you think?
I understood why they paid attention.
Oh, what a wonderful story. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That is such a... And I've had this experience with some of my clients when I can video them and record them after they've, you know, gotten themselves together, and they see themselves now as other people are now seeing this new person, and boy, do they get readjusted mentally, and they stand a little taller, and they stride a little freer. It is a wonderful thing to see the transformation. That's a wonderful story. Yes, sir. Okay. Should we stop him right there? Yeah. Yes. Can we talk later? I'll say just one thing. I'll just say one thing. A lot of women will fall for a puppy. So if you seem a bit vulnerable and undefended and open, a lot of women will find that very attractive rather than being the standoffish, big, strong, silent type. So you might consider that, sir.
Can't use the
power. Not at that point. There's other situations when you should. Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. Pick one of those, would you? Because I could talk for an hour on that. What would be the most important thing you'd like to know? Pick one. Intonation. Sure. Sure, yeah. Okay. And what, do you know what language you're mostly dealing with? Chinese. Okay. There's a lot of people who speak English in Chinese. Meaning they have English words and sentences, but all the other attributes of spoken language stay in the mother tongue. Now, we need to appreciate that these other aspects, the intonation patterns, are absorbed when the child is very, very young. So it's really part of the way they breathe and the way they hear. And the problem is that meaning is deep in intonation. But they don't know that when they're taught English because they think language is one word after the other. String them together, boom, I got a sentence. But how we intone it is part of the meaning, and they need to be taught that specifically. Now, as a natural-born, say, English speaker, you were never taught that, but you picked it up practically in the womb. But the foreign-born person needs to have it pointed out specifically, intentionally, and deliberately that these particular patterns exist. Now, I do that, and it depends on what they need. If they can follow me auditorially, if I said, Joe ordered the ham sandwich, which is different from Joe ordered the ham sandwich. Has two entirely different meanings, doesn't it? So if they can hear the difference with their ears, we can imitate, we can record, and have them internalize the experience. They have to do a lot of imitating. So I'll tell you something now that sounds really weird, but it's true. When you're changing speech, you have to get them the mouth to teach the brain how to do it. You got to put the motor patterns in the mouth again and again and again for the brain to pick up. That's how to direct it when it comes from the inside. So you put it in the ears, bring it out the mouth, it'll get up to the brain. I also do written marks to show when you go up and when you go down. And they have to learn how to use that, too. Just because you drew it doesn't mean that they will be able to follow it. So either the visual or the auditory or both, you have to deal with it directly. Yes, ma'am.
I have a tendency to speak too rapidly, particularly when I'm really excited when I have ideas I want to convey.
Yeah. Have you ever really listened to yourself in a recording while you did the behavior you're describing? I knew it. Yeah, okay. Not just you, ma'am, but everybody here, you have a certain impression about the way you talk. And remember Lenny? You could be accurate or you could be very mistaken in how that comes across. So before, you know, I try to address that, I would say, are you really sure you do that? Okay. It really helps if you do hear yourself because it gives you great motivation to change. When you just sit and just really listen to it and say, whoa, I could have left that out. And that was repeated from what I said here, or I sound so young and I want to sound a grown-up. I mean, really confront it, because you got to do the emotional work to help yourself pull out of that excited delivery. Okay, now I'm going to say the big sentence now, and not be so connected with your own emotion as you are with the person that you're talking to. So practice, thoughtfulness, and maturity will help you do that. The more you get other focused in your communication, the more you will deliver your language in a way that is appropriate for them and not your emotional display. Yes, ma'am. Last question. Big. And what was the last phrase, and what?
And have you helped them in
self-help? I have to think. Would you tell me what the, if it is somebody who's like hogging you at a party and they just keep talking, is that the specific or is it something else? Oh, yes. I have another aunt just like that, yes. Yeah. It's not Fritzy. Fritzy listens. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know what? This is the kind of question that is so difficult because there's no right answer for this. The right answer would be, it depends. Because human communication is so complex. There are so many variables. It depends on who is it? What's the relationship? Who's watching? How much do you care about that? Where is it happening? Because you can't answer that simply. And I might say, if that is who they are, who are you to change them? Okay, this could be one order of answer. And why is it that you should change them? So I would need to delve into it so much more that we don't have time for, but we can talk at the reception. Now, if it's a conversation, and then I'm done. If somebody gets you in a conversation and goes into a nonstop long story, are you with me? You been there? Okay. I'll give you the formula of how to get out of that. All right. Look them straight in the eye. Reach out and hold their arm. Now, the only place you can hold an arm is right here. That's the public place, okay? Now just put your hand there, boom. You can't touch anybody else socially, uh-uh. I mean, if they're strangers, but it's okay to touch here. Say their name right in their face, okay? Patrick. Now, boom, that gets them. You've just done a big step with the touch, the name, and looking right in their face. Patrick, they're probably going to startle and stop. At this point, you throw them a bouquet. Not much. But a bouquet, and it's been good to see you. That's what I mean by a bouquet. Something nice. it's been great to see you. And then you give them a leaving statement. I must go now. Okay? Now, sometimes, if it's not quite as extreme, you can give them a plausible excuse. Doesn't have to be true. Just has to be plausible. Okay? All right. I've got to put money in the meter. I told the babysitter I'd be home, but you should have a baby if you use that one. You know, they... You can give them a plausible excuse, unless this is the second time you've tried that and it hasn't worked. Okay, okay. Give them, throw them a bouquet, give them a plausible excuse, give them an exit line. I must go now. And as you say that, start moving your feet backwards. Okay? Just move back, turn, and walk away. All right? Which I'm going to do right now. Good night.